So we're beginning at December the 22nd, 1904, in volume 6. And the heading is that the more the soul is empty and humble, the more the divine light fills her. Now, we're coming, therefore, to something that is absolutely key to the whole divine will experience, and that is that unless we empty ourselves, there's no room for God. Is that all right? If I want to fill this with something else, I have to empty it of the water that's in it. That's the logic. So Louisa says, as I was in my usual state, I saw little baby Jesus with a fistful of light in his hand. Now, that seems a very simple image, but in actual fact, it's an image of the omnipotence of God, because he alone is the author of light, and God is light. I remained enchanted, and he told me, my daughter, perfection is light. That's a major statement that's made there. 1 John 1:5, God is light. Okay? Perfection is light. That means that we have to be transformed to the point where we become light. Now, Jesus asked for that in Matthew 5:17, that we're to be the light of the world. And one who says he wants to reach it, this light, acts just like one who would want to clasp a body of light in his hand. He tries to clasp it. The light itself flows through his fingers, except his hand remains immersed in that light. Now, the light is God, and God alone is perfect. That's Luke 18:19. God alone is perfect. And the soul who wants to be perfect does nothing but sees shadows, the little drops of God. And sometimes she does nothing but live in the light alone, that is, in the truth. That's John 14:6. I am the way, the truth, and the life. And just as the light penetrates deeper and occupies more space, as the light penetrates deeper and occupies more space, the greater the void it finds and the deeper the place is. In the same way, the more the soul is empty and humble, the more the divine light fills her and communicates his graces and perfections to her. Now, God is the source of light. We have to be transformed into God. Therefore, we have to be transformed into light. But it can't happen if we don't put the ego aside. It's actually quite simple. So in the divine will adventure, which I like to call it, the motto has to be, not my will, but thine be done. And if the Lord knows that you are serious about putting aside your will, he'll give you loads of opportunities. He'll get awfully excited. Okay. So December 29, 1904. Most of the time, human weakness is lack of vigilance and lack of attention. Now, that is a very important statement. Very important, okay. Because what he's saying is that if we were vigilant and we were watching things, we wouldn't fall into half the faults and difficulties and sins that we do. That's what he's saying. So, Louisa said, as I was in my usual state, I was thinking about the most humiliating steps that our Lord suffered, and I would feel horror within myself. But then I would say to myself, Lord, forgive those who renew for you these sorrowful steps. Because the weakness of man is too great. At that moment, blessed Jesus came for a little, and he told me, my daughter, that which is said to be human weakness most of the time is lack of vigilance. Now, you need to colour that and underline it and put an NB beside it and everything else. Most of what is said to be human weakness is actually a lack of vigilance and of attention from one who is the leader, that is, from parents and superiors. In other words, somebody in charge of a child can train a child to goodness. But if you don't pay attention and you're not vigilant, then the child will fall into all kinds of problems. Is that correct? But it's true of us as adults as well. that we let ourselves off the hook and just simply say that it's human weakness. The Lord says, no, no, you're not paying attention. You're not looking at what's going on. In fact, when a person is watched over and checked and is not given the freedom she wants, not receiving this nourishment, the weakness is destroyed by itself. Now, that was one of the purposes of men and women going into community life and dedicating themselves to a religious life, so that they would have this discipline upon themselves day and night to help them to overcome their weaknesses and become saints quickly. Okay. That was the plan, if I can put it that way. So the weakness would be destroyed by itself, while yielding to one's weakness is simply the nourishment of becoming worse. So every time we yield to that weakness, the thing gets worse. And one of the gravest mistakes we make is to say, oh, but I was always like this. And if a person says, I was always like this, what they're saying is, I've no intention of changing. And so what they've done is they've blocked themselves from going forward, and they can make life hell for people trying to live with them. Okay. Then, so you can see that somebody living in the divine will has got to be very open to change, because you'll have to change all the time if you're to be transformed into light. Then the Lord added, ah, my daughter, just as the soul becomes impregnated with virtue, like a dry sponge becoming soaked with water, that is, with light. That means we become soaked with light. Now, light in these writings represents the divine will. So you become soaked with the divine will. And so you become soaked with beauty and grace and love, some of the great attributes of God, who is beauty and love. In the same way, sin and weaknesses that one yields to, impregnating the soul like a sponge, becomes like mud. You're absorbing darkness instead of light. You see, the opposite of light is darkness. And if the Lord uses the term mud, now it's not only with Louisa, but also with other saints. He uses the expression mud, meaning the things of the earth that pull you back way further down than even being an ordinary Christian, because you see, we were made from mud, if I can put it that way. So you're brought back to nothing. You're brought back to destruction. And so mud represents sin accepted, worldliness accepted, and therefore you're out of the spiritual life completely. So soaked with mud, that is, with darkness and ugliness and even with hatred against God. Now, you'll be shocked maybe at that language, but words that are used in Louisa's writings are used in the same way as in the Bible. And hatred means to repudiate, to push away. Whereas the modern use of that word means to reach out to destroy or kill. Okay, so it's a different meaning of the word. So I want to give you Luke 11, 34 to 36 for that. Luke 11. 34 to 36. So January 21, 1905, one who dishonors obedience dishonors God. Now, one of the things about Jesus is that obedience was the very center of his life. And I'm going to give you a summary of John's gospel. Okay, I'm going to give you one after the other. They're all texts from John, and they're literally a summary of this gospel. Okay. And the heading you give it is that Jesus did the will of the Father. Jesus did the will of the Father. And he's our model. We have no other model. So John 4, 30, 5, 34, 6, 38, 8, 28, 8, 29, 8, 55, 10, 29, 10, 38, 12, 50, and 14, 31. Have you got that? Now, those texts, in those texts, Jesus says, I always do the will of my Father. I don't do my own will. I only reveal what the Father tells me to reveal. I only teach what the Father tells me to teach. The Father and I are one. Okay. And it culminates in 14:31 with these incredible words. Jesus says, I want the world to know that I love the Father, and therefore I do exactly what my Father tells me. Now, that's what Louisa is being trained to live, is those words. To prove that she loves the Father by doing exactly what the Father wants. And this obedience to God and to his law has got to come into us as well. So this is January the 21st, 1905. It's only a few lines. After I exposed certain doubts to the confessor, my mind could appease itself with what he said to me. Then when blessed Jesus came, he told me, my daughter, if one reasons over obedience, by merely reasoning over it, he dishonors it. And one who dishonors obedience dishonors God. Now, what he's saying is, when you start rationalizing it, now, the thing that has destroyed religious life today is the simple thing that there is no obedience, even though they have taken vows. What they do is, and they'll tell you themselves, just ask them, you don't have to ask me. What they will tell you themselves is that the superior wants something done, and the person who is to do it will come and talk it all out and agree only to what they will do. That's not obedience. That's rationalising, and that you will decide, I'll do it under my conditions, my way, and I'll only do the bits I want. That's not obedience. Obedience is completely different. It's surrender. Okay. And obedience is a very powerful thing. In fact, Jesus says that the person who is truly obedient can conquer their own self much quicker than anybody else. Because you're letting your own will go aside for the sake of somebody else's. And we actually need that experience if we're going to know how to surrender to God in the divine will. So, September the 28th, 1905... The cross is the seed of virtue. Now, there's no way out of the cross, because you know if you're doing the hours of the Passion that Jesus says that when he took up the cross, he put you and me into it. And that was that. Each one of us was given a place in the cross. Therefore, all of us together have got to carry that cross to Calvary. All of us together, meaning the whole church. So, Louisa said, as I was feeling in suffering more than usual, my adorable Jesus came for just a little and he told me, my daughter, the cross is the seed of virtue. And just as one sows harvest for 10, 20, 30 or even 100, in the same way, the cross being seed multiplies virtues and perfections and it embellishes them in an admirable way. Now, for the subject of the seed, go to Matthew 13:23. Matthew 13 speaks about the sower and the seed. So the more crosses thicken around you, the more seeds of virtue are sown in your soul. Now what he's saying there is, when a cross or a difficulty or a trial comes to you, that's your opportunity for growing in patience, growing in kindness, growing in love, growing in humility, growing in forgiveness, growing in everything. That's what he means. So the very fact that a cross has been laid upon you is the opportunity to grow in all of these things. And he says that, he doesn't say it here, but other people say it outside of this text. A Christian without a cross is an anachronism. Therefore, instead of afflicting yourself when a new cross comes to you, you should rejoice. Now, Louisa will tell you in the higher volumes that when you're going through a time of difficulty or trial, what you say to the Lord, and I've had an opportunity to do this since Christmas, every day, every solitary day, I adore your holy dispositions towards me. And that means you accept carte blanche what he has sent to you, regardless of the human circumstances, the whys or the wherefores, the rights or the wrongs or anything else. I adore your holy dispositions towards me. and you give them a chance to work with you. So therefore, instead of afflicting yourself when a new cross comes, you should rejoice, thinking that you are acquiring another seed with which you can enrich and even complete your crown. So that's Matthew 13, 31 to 32. So February the 8th, 1905, we're talking about the characteristics of the children of God. Love of the cross. Now notice love of the cross, not just tolerance of it. Love of the glory of God and love of the glory of the church. Now notice there's nothing selfish there at all, nothing for me. Continuing in my poor state of privation and of unspeakable bitterness, Louisa said, Jesus makes himself seen in silence, and you know now that means that he's chastising. And he told her, my daughter, the characteristics of my children are love of the cross, love of the glory of God, and love of the glory of the church to the point of laying down their lives. Beside that, I want you to put Romans 8:29. Romans 8:29, that we would be in the image of the Son. One who does not have these characteristics in vain calls them my son. One who dares to say it is a liar and a traitor who betrays God and himself, which is very strong language. Take a look at yourself and see whether you have them, he said to her. Okay. And no wonder he disappeared. Okay. That was in case she'd react. February the 10th, 1905. And this talks about what the contentments of the soul are about. Louisa said, I was in my usual state and I felt a discontentment about myself. And when blessed Jesus came, I felt myself entering into such contentment that I said, Ah, Lord, you alone are my true contentment. And he said, and I say to you, the first contentment of the soul is God alone. Now that's exactly what Teresa of Avila said, God alone sufficeth. She was 16th century, as you know. God alone sufficeth. So the first contentment is God alone. The second contentment is when the soul within herself and outside of herself looks at nothing but God. There goes your late, late show. The third one is when, as the soul finds herself in this divine sphere, no created object, nor creatures, nor riches can break the divine image within her mind. Now, you see, the terrible problem that we have is that we're inundated with television, internet, gadgets, radio, you name it. They're all there, saturating your mind. It's extremely difficult to come to a point where you can have the divine aspect all the time. I have to say it to you, I've been kind up to now, you have to turn off some of these gadgets. You have to turn them off. Because you can't, we've only got one mind. You can't be switched into all of these worldly channels, feeding all their worldly ideas, and switched into God at the same time. It doesn't work. Have you ever tried praying after the Late Late Show or something like that? It wouldn't work. Why? Because your mind is full of anything that's not God. Even if they're talking about exorcism. Okay. So the third is when the soul finds herself in this divine sphere. No created object, nor creatures, nor riches can break the divine image within her mind. In fact, the mind nourishes itself with what it thinks. Look at that. And by looking at God alone, of the things down here, she looks only at those that God wants, not bothering about anything else, and so she remains always in God. The fourth contentment is suffering for God, because in order for the soul and God to maintain their conversation, to be more intimately clasped together, and to prove their love to each other, God calls the soul and the soul answers. God draws near to the soul and embraces him. God gives her suffering and the soul gladly suffers. I adore your divine dispositions towards me. And rather, she desires to suffer more for love of him, so as to be able to say to him, "Do you see how I love you?" And this is the greatest of all contentments. We have a way to go, haven't we? Mm-hmm. Yeah. But one of the big ways to get there is to turn off the gadgets. Because they're an absolutely maximum distraction. February 24th, 1905. I love this. Humility is a flower without thorns. I mean, we love the rose, but it has thorns, hasn't it? Okay. This morning, Blessed Jesus came for just a little, and he told me, "My daughter, humility is a flower without thorns. It doesn't damage anybody. It doesn't damage yourself. It doesn't damage anybody else. Humility never attacks, ever." Okay. So you'll have a way of finding out how much of it you have. And because it is without thorns, it can be held in one's hand, it can be clasped, it can be placed wherever one wants without fear of being bothered or pricked. Or the roses will tell you whether you touch them or not. Such is the humble soul. One can say that she does not have the pricks of defects. Look at that. And since she is without pricks, one can do with her whatever one wants. Now, who is it that wants to pick up the soul and hold it in his hand and hold it to his heart and all the rest of it without pricks? It's the Lord. So he doesn't want us attacking him while he's actually picking us and wanting to love us and all the rest of it. And he says, to be a rose without thorns, you have to have the humility. Okay. In other words, humility is mild. Now, that is, blessed are the meek, they shall inherit the earth. So that should be Matthew 5:10, I think it is. Maybe it's further than that, but it's the Beatitudes. Matthew 5. And since she is without pricks, one can do with her whatever one wants. Not having thorns, naturally she does not prick nor cause bother to others. So a humble person is very easy to live with because they're not prickly towards anybody else either. But there are some people who are so prickly that you have to be very careful how you say good morning. It mightn't be the right way to do it. And you might have forgotten to give them a brilliant smile to go with it. And you'll get it back. I'm sure you've never met anybody like that. And if you make the dinner, there's definitely something wrong. If it just wasn't cooked the way they want it. That's the pricks coming back at you. Okay. To be a rose without thorns is to have this extraordinary humility. And it's amazing. That person's very easy to live with. I know people like that. They're so easy to live with. Because thorns are given by one who has them. Ouch. So you don't prick other people unless you have the prickly inside of you. Now, isn't that told to us in the most charitable manner? But if one doesn't have one, how can you give them? Not only this, but humility is a flower which strengthens and clears one's sight. You have to put a huge NB beside that. Absolutely, that's utterly vital. Humility clears the internal spiritual vision. And our internal vision is clouded by all kinds of things to do with self, all kinds of faults and failings that we have, which of course we think is everybody else's faults and failings, because we project onto others, okay? But humility gives you the ability to actually see what you're looking at. And that's my definition of discernment. Discernment is that you see what you're looking at. So if I hold up this bottle of water and say to you that it's made of glass, the bottle, then you say there's something wrong with Francis, because if your eyesight is better, you know better. Is that okay? So humility gives you the ability to be able to see things for what they really are. And I remember a conversation that Pope John Paul II had with university students in Germany a number of years ago, in which they asked him to tell them how to be Christian in society as it is today. Now, he said a number of things, but the thing that really stayed with me was, he said, call everything by its real name. That's the discernment, you see. He said, call sin, sin. Then you'll never fall into it. Call grace, grace. Call life, life. Call death, death. Call everything by its real name, he said, and you won't trip. There's the vigilance of someone being able to actually see correctly. So humility is the flower that strengthens and clears one's sight. And with its clearness, it knows how to stay away from the thorns themselves as well. Okay. So March the 2nd, 1905, Jesus gives Louisa the key to his will. This is a huge thing. Continuing in my usual state, I found myself outside of myself and I found myself with a key in my hand. And even though I was covering a long way, and sometimes I would get distracted, even she admits that, yet as soon as I would think about the key, I would always find it in my hand. Now, this is a very simple picture that she's been given, that if we keep remembering the divine will, we'll always come back to the centre. Now, she gets it pictorially so that she can pass it on to us very, very simply. If it was given to you in a high intellectual statement, you might think it was difficult. Let me illustrate what she is getting. If in my hand I'm holding this bottle of water, I'm not going to forget to drink, am I? No, because it's in my hand. And she's saying if the divine will is in your hand or you're holding onto it, you're not going to forget. You'll keep coming back to it. Is that okay? Because I believe that once you illustrate these things, it's fine. You understand that. Now I could see that this key served to open a palace. That's the palace of the divine will. And inside it, there was the baby Jesus sleeping. But I could see everything from afar, and I was all in haste, in a hurry to go there and open it for fear that he might wake up, that he might cry, or he would not find me near him. So I hastened more and more, and when I got there, just about to go up, I found myself inside of myself, that she's back out of the ecstasy. And I remained concerned. However, afterwards, when blessed Jesus came, he said, my daughter, the key that you always found in your hand is the key of my will, which I have placed in your hands, and one who has an object in his hand can do with it whatever they want. So you can do the most wonderful things with the divine will if you're holding on to it. Okay. Now notice he gives you the divine will. And then you can decide what you want to do with it. You can decide how many souls you want to save and all the rest of it. It's incredible. So March the 5th, 1905 is just a sentence. As I was suffering a little more than usual, blessed Jesus came for a little and told me, my daughter, the cross is the support of the weak, the strength of the strong, and the seed and the custody of virginity. In other words, the cross really protects you from harm, whatever state you're in. Okay. So March the 20th, 1905, true love and true virtue must have their origin in God. If they don't have their origin in God, they're not really much use. Okay. Continue in my usual state. Blessed Jesus came for just a little and he told me, my daughter, the love which does not have its origin in God cannot be called true love. Because on earth we call lots of things love, whether they are or whether they're not. The world outside calls something love. And if you pull back the label, you read L-U-S-T. But they call it love. Am I right or wrong? How do you know it's lust? By their fruits you will know them. It's as simple as that. If it was love, our society would be an incredible society. Half the nation wouldn't be in hospital. Okay? We would have families that were not breaking apart. We would have schools that would be operating correctly. We'd have hospitals that were operating correctly. We'd have a society that was totally strong, because the strength of a people is the moral strength of the nation. Sorry, the strength of a nation is the moral strength of its people. That's something that's been known forever. And so if what they're calling love out there was actually correct, you'd have all of these results. But if the place is disintegrating, then you know it's not love. It's something else. That's what he means by its origin is not in God. So you're talking about false love there. Okay. The love which does not have its origin in God cannot be called true love. And the virtues themselves, which do not have their origin in God, are falsified virtues. That means people are leaning on their own human nature to be good. And if you're leaning on human nature without grace, you're not going very far. Look at a movement that has been happening in Ireland over the past 20 years. We won't go back any further than that. And that is a movement away from God, away from grace. And what do you have? Daily murders. It's a sure sign. Human beings are not able to be good without grace, without God. You just can't do it. Look at Genesis chapter 3. They broke the relationship with God. Genesis chapter 4, first murder. That's how it is. And the murder simply means that, and you see this almost daily in Ireland, the murder simply means that when two people have a difficulty with each other, all the feelings get out of control. The person did not intend to kill that one. We're hearing this in the courts every day, aren't we? But they drank too much or whatever it is, and now they can't control their feelings and they lash out at somebody else and you have a body as a result. So no grace, count the bodies. All right. So if it doesn't have their origin in God, it's false. Indeed, everything which does not have its origin in God can be called neither love nor virtue, but rather apparent light or false light that ends up converting into darkness. Now, I want to give you Matthew chapter 5, verses 29 and 30, where Jesus says, if your eye causes you to sin, if your hand causes you to sin, do you remember? If your foot causes you to sin. Matthew 5, 29 to 30. And what you think is light ends up in darkness. Okay. Then he added, for example, a confessor who works and sacrifices himself very much for a soul is something holy. It apparently gives of heroism. And yet if he does so because he obtained or hopes to obtain something, the origin of the sacrifice is not in God but himself. He's only serving himself. Is that okay? And the awful thing is, in these writings, the Lord will show you that you can have, in other people's eyes, you may be a very holy person, and in God's eyes, you're nothing, because the motivation is all wrong. And if the motivation for self is there, forget about it. The action has no value in God's eyes. So the intention is everything. But we got that very much given to us in volumes 1 to 4 about the intention, the intention, the intention. Okay. So let's go on to March 23, 1905. Glory and satisfaction of Jesus. As I was in my usual state, blessed Jesus came for a little, and I said to him, Lord, what is my state? Lord, is my state, your glory? And he said, my daughter, all my glory and my satisfaction is solely that I want the whole of you more in me. Now that's Deuteronomy chapter 6, verses 4 to 10. I want the whole of you. Now Deuteronomy 6, 4 to 10 says, hear, O Israel, the Lord your God is one Lord, and you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, all your soul, all your mind, and all your being. Underline all the alls. But a lover never wants 80% of the beloved, do they? No, they want the whole of the person. Because that's what love is. Love seeks union. love seeks oneness. Okay. Then he added, everything is in the soul's distrust and fear of herself and her trust and confidence in God. Now, Proverbs 3:5. My son, lean not on your own understanding. Trust in God. Proverbs 3:5. It's one of the famous statements of the Old Testament. So what we're being told here is that you do not rely on yourself, you rely on God. As you go on in these writings, the Lord is going to show you, you don't even look at your miseries or your faults and your failings. Look at Jesus only and love him only, and he will bring you to great sanctity. He will bring you to great sanctity. It's actually not difficult. I should say it's not difficult to understand. It's just difficult to do if you love yourself too much. So March 28th, 1905. Now, you remember volumes 1 to 4, all the time Jesus was telling her, do not allow disturbance on the inside. So we're going to get a message about that again. Louisa said, as I was in my usual state, blessed Jesus came for just a little. And since I had said to a soul that was disturbed, think of not wanting to be disturbed, not only for your own good, but more so out of love for our Lord. Because a soul who is disturbed is not only disturbed herself, but makes Jesus Christ disturbed. Now, that means that you disturb the action of God in yourself. Now, if you're disturbed on the inside, it allows Satan to move in to tempt. And human beings have an instinct that when a person is down, they kick them. Am I right or am I right? Yeah. So this disturbance on the inside is very dangerous. Let me give you an illustration. If there's a storm outside here, you look out, but it's not in the room. It's not on the inside. So you can survive. You can outlive the storm. You can deal with it. But if the storm comes into the room, then you have a huge problem and you've got to get out of the room. That's why if the storm or the disturbance comes on the inside into your inner being, then God isn't able to move in, but Satan moves in very fast to pull you down. Is that all right?
Yes.
So that this disturbance is very important. That's why when we give spiritual direction to people, we say to them, now, is the problem on the outside or the inside? And initially they look at you and I explain about the storm. And then if they say the problem's on the outside, oh, that's OK. We'll talk it through. You're all right. You're actually OK if it's on the outside and not on the inside. And I know some people in Divine Will who have been tried and tested to an absolutely, in my opinion, heroic degree. And they have total peace, the peace that passes all understanding, on the inside. The storm is outside of them. Even if the storm is in the family. Okay? The storm is outside of them. They still have the peace that passes all understanding on the inside. Therefore, the Lord can do incredible things for that family through this person. Now do you get it? Because the Lord is enthroned in that household once this person keeps the Lord's throne untouched. You just have to see the logic of what we're doing. Okay. So later I said to myself, what nonsense, Louisa said. Jesus can never be disturbed. Then on coming, he told me, my daughter, instead of nonsense, you actually spoke the truth. In fact, in each soul, I form a divine life. He bilocates himself in us, is the way we're told about it in the higher volumes. And if the soul is disturbed, this divine life that I keep forming also remains disturbed. Not only this, but it never comes to being properly completed. Okay, so for that I want to give you, first of all, Ephesians 2:10. We're God's work of art and he keeps trying to perfect us. Ephesians 2:10. And the other one I want to give you is Philippians 1:6, that the Lord will complete a work in us if we allow him to do it. But he says very clearly in volumes 1-4 that he can only work in peace because he's a god of peace. And so if there's disturbance on the inside, it does block it. Louisa said, "Then I continued my usual interior work on the Passion. And as I reached the point of the encounter of Jesus and Mary on the way of the cross, he made himself seen again and told me, 'My daughter, the soul also I encounter continuously. And if the encounter I make with the soul, I find her in the act of exercising virtues and united with me, she repays me for the sorrow I suffered when I encountered my mother, so sorrowful because of me.'" So he's saying that he meets you and I at every single second of your life. Make sure you place the intention at some point that you want to meet him with adoration, praise, honour, glory, and so on. That you actually tell him, "I want to meet you every time with this approach coming from me." Because placing the intention is extremely important. So April the 11th, 1905. How perseverance is the seal of eternal life. Now, perseverance is extremely important. You probably know that Mount Everest is littered with gear left behind by people who thought they were going to have the time of their lives and they were going to conquer a mountain. And there are three stages on the way up. Okay. And actually, it's a most wonderful parable because there are three stages in the spiritual life. Okay. And at stage one, most of the ones who were really properly prepared managed to get past stage one. But some people didn't and went back from stage one. But they actually went back with all their equipment because they weren't too high. Stage two, vast majority turned back. But they couldn't carry the equipment because the air wasn't strong enough. And so the place is littered with human equipment. Stage three has more junk than anywhere else, where people were so close to the goal and they just couldn't make it. Now, St. John of the Cross doesn't talk about Mount Everest, the poor guy, and probably didn't know about it either. He was in the 16th century. But he said that the greatest tragedy in the spiritual life is that crowds begin, very few finish. And the real tragedy is how many stop about 4 yards from the goal. In other words, you stop just before you win. Yeah, that's the tragedy of us. We can say, "Look, I'm tired, I've had enough, blah, blah, blah." And so perseverance is extremely important. And Jesus speaks about it quite a lot in volumes 1-4. And he comes back again on it here. Louisa says, "Being very afflicted because of the privation of my adorable Jesus, I was saying to myself, 'How cruel he has become with me. I myself cannot understand how his good heart can reach the point of doing this.'" Now, this is volume 6. She does know that the privation is because he's chastising and all the rest of it. But, you know, We're not very logical in our emotions, are we? Your head can say da-da-da-da and all the rest of it, but your emotions are completely different. We are very like small children spiritually. And a small child who's told that the mother has gone down to the shop to get milk for the child will be at the window thinking she's gone forever. She's only gone 5 minutes. The shop's only down the road. But the child cannot tolerate the absence of the mother. Does that make sense? So the child gets into a crisis. If the mother stops to talk to a neighbour, she has a real crisis when she comes home. But you know that if you left your little doggy for a day or two as well, the doggy will get into a crisis as well, giving you the same reaction. Okay. Now, spiritually, we're like that. And so while logically Louisa knows that he's chastising, that's not where she's at. And as far as she's concerned, he's abandoned me. Okay. And, you know, if she read her own writings, she'd be amazed at how often she says it. Do you know what I mean? But spiritually, it's like as if we live the whole of our lives in one day, just as children do. And therefore, if you feel you're not able to contact the Lord today, you think it's all over and done with. I mean, I've had over the years, I've had many people come and tell me it's all over. It was only a bubble. It was fantastic while it was going on, but it's all over. I said, what's all over? I always remember one particular person. She was in a real tizzy about it. She'd had a wonderful charismatic experience and everything was grand for years, and now it was all dried up, you see. And I said, you sound like someone telling a counsellor that the honeymoon's over and you've got to get down with ordinary everyday life. And the washing is waiting for you and the floor has to be cleaned and the children have to be taken care of and everything. And the wonderful emotional high that you had and can't have every day because that's not real life. She looked at me and I said, are you going to smile? Come on, do yourself the favour of smiling. You're having reality therapy. This is Monday morning, it's not Sunday. Okay. We're like that spiritually. That's the only reason why I'm saying it. That we think that, it'll never come back. And you hear Louisa saying that all the time. It's fascinating. Okay. But beside it, because she's really suffering, I want to put Psalm 22, verses 1 to 4. My God, why have you forsaken me? Do you remember it? So while I was saying this and other nonsense, all of a sudden he came and he said, indeed, that of the soul which pleases me the most is perseverance. Okay. Because perseverance is the seal of eternal life. And the development of divine life, perseverance. Okay. Now I want to give you Hebrews 12 verses 1 to 4. And I want to give you Luke 18. It would be verses 1 to 10 for the widow and the unjust judge. Remember, she persevered until she got it. You have another lady, and I think, I don't know whether she's in Luke 18 or not as well, the Syrophoenician woman who wouldn't let Jesus off the hook, and Jesus seemed to insult her and everything. And she said, it's all right, you can say what you like. I still want you to heal my daughter. It's okay. I think she's fantastic. She's absolutely fantastic. She wouldn't take any rebukes. Sorry? Matthew? Oh, it would be in Luke and as well. A Syrophoenician woman. So these are people who persevered. And you also have teaching in Luke 11, the teaching on prayer, in which you're told to persevere. And do you remember the man arriving in the middle of the night? And he's told to go away because the children are getting disturbed. But he perseveres and he gets the bread to keep the kids asleep. So that was the motivation given to him. He says, right, you can keep them asleep if you give me the bread. So the perseverance is terribly important. And as we go on in these volumes, you'll find a number of examples just in the volumes following this where Louisa intercedes with Jesus and she will not let him off the hook. She says, okay, and then she goes on. And if he gives her what in any way could be thought of as a rebuke, she still goes on and she perseveres and she perseveres and she gets what she asks for. So perseverance is extremely important. In fact, just as God is ever old and ever new, do you remember St. Augustine? Oh, beauty so ancient and so new, late have I loved thee. Okay, he's ever old and ever new. And immutable, that means never changes. That's the problem that people have when society goes into rebellion, as our society has gone into rebellion against God. God never changes. And they think that God's law should change because they've changed. And when God's law doesn't change because they've changed, then they persecute because they've got bad consciences. Okay. So God is ever old and ever new and immutable. In the same way, through perseverance, by having exercised it always, the soul is old and by her attitude of exercising it ever new. In other words, like God. Okay. And each time she exercises it, she's renewed in God, remaining immutable and without realizing it. Since through perseverance she continuously acquires divine life within herself, by acquiring God, she is sealed with eternal life. That means you die and you go to heaven. Now, in the higher volumes, Jesus says that 9 out of 10 people on this planet go to purgatory if they've done at least the minimum required. Do you know what I mean? But he also says that someone genuinely living the divine will go straight to heaven. Purgatory is not for them. Can there be a seal safer than God himself? And Louisa will tell you that when Saint Hannibal de Francia actually went to heaven, that the saints were shocked at him bringing the glory of God with him and bringing the presence of the divine will with him and bringing all of the wonderful things that went with it. Okay, so we'll go to the next one, which is April the 16th, 1905. And notice that the title is Suffering is Reigning. That's not how we look at suffering, is it? Continuing in my usual state, my beloved Jesus made himself seen for a little with a nail inside of his heart. And drawing near to my heart, he would touch it with that nail and I would feel mortal pains. Then he said to me, "My daughter, it is the world that drives this nail deep into my heart, giving me continuous death." I want to give you 1 John 2:15. 1 John 2:15. So by justice, just as they give me continuous death, I will allow that they give death among themselves. This is 1905. What is he talking about? World War One. Okay. I will allow that they give death among themselves, killing one another like many dogs. I think 70 million were killed in World War One. And while saying this, he made me hear the screams of the rebel to the point that I remained deafened for 4 or 5 days. Imagine. And then, as I was very much in suffering, he came back a little later and he told me, "Today is the day of the palms, in which I was proclaimed king. All must aspire to a kingdom, but in order to acquire the eternal kingdom, it is necessary for the creature to acquire the power over herself through the dominion of her passions." You notice I adjusted the text there. Do you see it? We have to have power over ourselves to get dominion over the passions. The only means is suffering, because suffering is reigning. That is, through patience, man puts himself in his place, becoming king of himself and of his eternal kingdom. This is ruling over yourself, okay? And the Lord says that if we don't rule over ourselves, we've no right to rule over anybody else. We don't even know what ruling is, do we? We don't even know what authority is. And in these writings and in the writings of the other saints, Jesus says that to have dominion over yourself is to be a king or an emperor on the earth. And there are people with big high jobs in government and all the rest of it, and if they're not ruling over themselves, then he says they're worse than slaves. Okay. We'll do one more and then we'll take a break. April the 20th, 1905. In these times, humanity is like a bone out of place. A bone out of place doesn't feel good, does it? "As I was in my usual state," Louisa said, "Blessed Jesus came for just a little, almost in the act of chastising the people, and he said, 'My daughter, creatures lacerate my flesh. They trample upon my body continuously, and I will permit that their flesh be lacerated and their blood dispersed.'" Because you know in these writings you're told that sin rises up from the earth. God has a post office up there and he says, "Return to sender." So sin rises up and comes back to the earth as chastisement. In other words, we create the chastisement, because nothing or unholy or unworthy can enter the presence of God. It's that simple. So sin cannot penetrate into the heavens. It's not allowed. And so it comes back to the earth. And if there's too much sin, the earth rebels against us. So you have water rebelling against us in tsunamis. You have the earth rebelling against us in volcanoes and earthquakes. You have the air rebelling against us in hurricanes and so on. But it's created by us. And we shouldn't be giving out about climate change. We should be looking for change inside of ourselves. So in these times, humanity is like a bone out of place, out of its centre. And in order to put it in its place again and to make it re-enter into its centre, it is necessary that it be undone. Now, if I give you that in modern language, a surgeon will say to you, I can put you back again, but I have to take you apart first. I have to do this major thing inside of you. There will be life afterwards. It's going to be very uncomfortable. It'll take a long time to recover and blah, blah, blah. But if we don't do it, you get worse and worse, and it's death. Then calming himself a little, he added, my daughter, the soul can know whether she has dominated her passions. If touched by temptations or by people, very often it's people, isn't it? She does not take it into consideration. In other words, you're not prickly. And everything that people say or do to you is not a crisis. For example, she's tempted to impurity. If she has dominated this passion, the soul doesn't take it into consideration, and her very nature remains in its place. So there's the temptation to lust. If, on the other hand, she hasn't taken control, the soul becomes annoyed and she afflicts herself. You get upset because you go into a struggle. And she feels a rotten stream flow within her body. Or one person mortifies or insults someone else. And this one has dominated the passion of pride. She remains at peace and therefore it's not a problem. But of course, if pride hasn't been put in its place, there's a huge problem, isn't there?
Yeah.
Because if pride is dominating, then you take insults where they weren't intended. If, on the other hand, she hasn't put it in its place, she feels a stream of fire, indignation, of pride within herself, which turns her completely upside down. And that's the origin of many of these homicides that are happening in Ireland today. In fact, when the passion is there, at the occasion, it comes out into the field, and so all the rest. In other words, if we're to get anywhere in life, let alone anywhere in the spiritual life, and even more so anywhere in the divine will, we have got to be people who reign over this little kingdom inside of us. Is that okay? You can't do it by yourself, John 15:5, but you can do it with Jesus. And a very simple thing, if you're in trouble or temptation, is to say, Jesus, cover me with your precious blood so that you and I together can conquer this thing. I can't do it by myself, but you and I can do it together because he wants you involved. So I'll give you a break.